agenda on behalf of these talks. So I wanted to see if it's the case, and I really had that idea in my mind as well. So I conducted more than 70 interviews with both parties, but I didn't choose them randomly. So this they have to know about this interplay. They have to be in those meetings. So it took me quite a long time to figure out who were in those. So I found out these interviews, and I carried out starting with 2018, and it lasted for 3 years in Istanbul, Ankara, Tunis, and London. And what emerged from these interviews was not a set of ideals or actions dictated by Islamism as an ideology, but something unexpected. It was a recurring theme of every interview, and it was a theme of success. In every single conversation, without exception, the notion of and longing for success surfaced naturally and became the central focus of the study without any prompting on my part. The Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and Ennahda were keen on understanding and learning what the AKP, or in other words, back then, the Turkish model was so successful. This model was, as you would remember, was backed and promoted, or in one of the words of one of the Ikhwanis, marketed to the Arab world by Western policymakers, Western leaders, think tanks, and Turkish soft power entities, and Islamist organizations, especially late Karadavi's IUMS, and academics as well. So just remember back in 2011, Turkey was still seen as the preferred Muslim power by the West because of its NATO membership, and the EU accession process was still ongoing, and the strong ties with European markets still ongoing. So in other words, from the point of view of the Nahdawis and Ikhwanis right after the revolution, this AKP, because they were they had really close relationship with its mother movement, who AKP had a rift. So they never thought AKP as Islamist enough, but Muslim enough. So authentic, but most importantly, successful. So they wanted to learn from the AKP and adopt the policies or whatever AKP is giving them. We don't know then. And it had a legitimizing power, because you have to realize that these parties were, even though Muslim Brotherhood had the opportunity to stand in elections with independent candidates, it never aspired to assume, quote unquote, it was never a free election, let alone for Nahdawis. They were persecuted and not even in Tunisia before Ben Ali was ousted. So they all needed technocratic and practical assistance, despite being much older and much structural political movements than the AKP. They lacked experience of functioning as a professionalized political party, let alone governing from a position of power. Here you can see the initial assistance provided to them was strikingly basic. But you know, many of the meetings were actually filled with talking about these very small Kutodian parts of political lives. So what was disseminated from the AKP to Ennahda and then to Ikhwan between 2011 and 2013 was a toolbox of tactics. In other words, it was a collection of insights into the workings of the political machine, and that had achieved success for the AKP within a political culture, that is Turkey, dominated usually by Islamist secular or Islamist anti-Islamist dichotomy. As you can see, this kind of political battlefield partly mirrors the backdrop of persecution that both Ikhwan and Nahda endured for decades in Egypt. So that was another reason cited by interviews from Ikhwan and Nahda that was said to have contributed to this interplay. So I identified four key categories that define these tactics that AKP provided. The tactics falling under these categories form the essential components that the AKP believed were key to its success. Similarly, in the post-uprising era, Ennahda and Ikhwan defined success as urgently prevailing in elections, which were actually, you know, made part of the the components of the revolution. Criticized this approach of Ikhwan, but they wanted to just go ahead with the election, win election, and attaining power, which was led by someone who's now in jail, Hayrat al-Shatir. It's very close a relationship with the AKP. Here, another very small snippet. You can see how the AKP played a hands-on role in shaping election strategies in Tunisia and Egypt. From 2011 to then 2014 for Ennahda and 2019 again for Ennahda. Obviously, you can't do that for Ikhwan since in 2013 Morsi government was ousted. They conducted tutorials before elections, organized workshops, they ran training programs tailored for various levels of administrative staff, and they also attempted to implement a rigorous polling schedule during the campaign. We're unable to do that for Ikhwan. As one Nahdawi put it, the AKP was regarded as a wow machine and election management was one of its most powerful engines. Another crucial tactic in the toolbox was the cultivation of a new bourgeoisie. This form of clientelism, which had been successfully used by the AKP, contributed tremendously to its consolidation of power, again winning elections and navigating political crisis. So likewise, the AKP argued that if a new business elite formed in Tunisia and Egypt, that would help the Nahdawis and Ikhwan stay in power and navigate the crisis and build alliances. So this vision led AKP-affiliated businessmen to visit Cairo and Tunis many times and help establish two business associations. And they were modeled after the AKP's own Musiat, roughly the conservative businessman, Muslim Business Association of Turkey. And they were operating under Musiat. But obviously, I don't want to get into what happened to them because it's another story. But that was the thinking, that one of the core tactics, like I said, in the prescription of success. So two postulations can be made about this toolbox that the AKP provided to Ennahda and Ikhwan between 2011 and 2013. While I've only shared a few snippets due to time constraints, I hope the key idea come across. Firstly, it seems that what diffused from were not specific policies, but rather selective tactics designed to be employed in times of crisis to bolster the political standing of these entities. The emphasis was on fortifying the positions of Ennahda and Ikhwan in their domestic settings and to equip them to navigate challenges effectively. Secondly, the tactics shared were notably stripped of ideological content. They were not about invoking Islam as a means of acquiring or maintaining power. Instead, the essence of the diffusion process centered on normalization, or one Ikhwani participant said, to look, act, and look normal as a political party. And the style was distinctly managerial, aimed at delivering pragmatic solutions to immediate problems. So complex issues, whether ideological or social, were simplified into practical challenges requiring step-by-step resolutions. So in this context, we can assume that success has become increasingly tied to a managerial approach, where Islamist movements prioritize effective governance and operational aspects of running a state. This includes adopting modern management techniques, which is why I describe them, some of the leaders in three of the entities, as the CEOs of Islam, because they focus on delivering efficient public services. This shift, I think, marks a significant departure from the traditional focus on purely ideological objectives. So this obviously ties into a, you know, broader concept of post-Islamism, but with a contribution to a post-Cold War era neoliberal rationality, but I will not go into that. If we could go back to revisit the idea of how to look at Islamist transnational ties, I think this is another way to say that, I mean, like Mariam said, some of the things can be looked at only by, you know, cost-benefit relations and calculus. To understand these dynamics, I believe we need to move beyond the Cold War era frameworks that oversimplifies and mischaracterize such complexities and transnational ties, because as this my research and my book shows, the interactions between these Islamist groups didn't represent a global Islamist political project like those imagined in the 1980s, and because it was beneficial to both, all three parties. It was it had a business clientelist benefit, and the idea of Islamist interconnectedness in this sense was overestimated, and it was, I don't think it was a pan-Islamic solidarity at all. I think I should, yeah.